Well, if you were like me, some of you guys might have been on Facebook this morning. I have a tendency, I want to see when everybody's birthdays are. I don't want to miss a birthday, so that's important to me to be able to say happy birthday to my Facebook friends. But I have a love-hate relationship with Facebook, do you? You know, I sit there and I get on it, and I am so interested in what you guys are doing. I want to look at all the pictures of the children and the grandchildren. But before I know it, it's half the morning, and I've still got wash left over in the, you know, in the bin and in the laundry room that I have to do, and I haven't gotten anything accomplished. So that's why I have a love-hate relationship. But what I really love is the reconnecting with people. Have you reconnected with people from your high school and your colleges that you haven't heard from or seen for years? Well, that happened to me. I reconnected with a friend of mine named Mary Ann. Now, she's living in Northern California. We played sports together in college, but hadn't really connected for 30 years. So here we are reconnecting on Facebook. Then I get this Facebook message from her, and she said that while she was swimming laps, getting ready for a triathlon, which is where our similarities end, she had this vision. She had a vision that we should combine our efforts and put on a retreat, a spiritual retreat, for the ladies that we went to college with at Texas Lutheran, down in Seguin, Texas. There was only one problem. She was in Northern California, I was in Northern Texas, and our school was down kind of in Southwest Texas, about 5 hours south of here, and we weren't sure how we were going to pull this off. But she had a vision, and as it turned out, it was a God vision. She said, what if we called it the way we were, the way we could be? I said, no, it's got to be the way we were, the way we can be. The way we can be. I had caught onto the vision, and so we began praying about this retreat. We did have our worries. We thought, well, what if no one comes? You know, we're planning this retreat. What if nobody comes? But God and His faithfulness did bring people. We had 17 the first year. Then we had 24 the second year. Then we repeated with 24 women the third year. And now we are making plans for our fourth annual Texas Lutheran Women's Retreat in July of 2013. Isn't that amazing? The Israelites also had a vision, just like that. They wanted to rebuild the wall surrounding Jerusalem that had been torn down during the siege of the Babylonians. We talked about that, remember, when we talked about Jeremiah and how the Babylonians came in and took all the people away captive. You remember all that? Well, now it's time to rebuild the wall. The problem is, they don't have a leader. Nehemiah, who was not on site, heard about the plight, and he felt a tug in his heart to do something about rebuilding that wall. But the problem was, Nehemiah was unavailable. Nehemiah was unavailable. Now, although Babylon conquered Israel in 586 BC, Persia then later overthrew Babylon, something like 53 years later, and eventually let the Israelites go back if they wanted to go back to Jerusalem. Nehemiah, however, remained in Persia. A lot of people did, a lot of the Jews did, because they got used to the Persian rug and sitting around that and having a good time. And they'd also had jobs. And they were comfortable. You know, Nehemiah had worked his way up. He probably was born in Persia. So that's all he knew. So he stayed there. Nehemiah had a very important job. He was the king's cupbearer. The cupbearer was the head of security for the entire kingdom of Persia. And what he did was risked his life every day for the king. He would take a drink of the king's drink to make sure that he wasn't slipped a lethal lemonade at any time. To drop everyone and to help his countrymen to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem would be unheard of. He'd probably risk his life if he even asked for such a thing. But when Nehemiah heard the news about the state of Jerusalem, he sat down and cried. Have you ever heard about something? That's how I felt when I heard about West. I had just passed through West just a few hours before to go down to San Antonio. And I just sat there and I wanted to cry because I felt helpless. I couldn't do anything. Nehemiah mourned, and he fasted, and he prayed, and then he ended his quiet time with these words, "Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this your servant, and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. Give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of this man." Favor for what? What man is he talking about? Ooh, he's talking about the king, that man, the king of Persia, King Artaxerxes. He was about to ask something that was unheard of before. Unheard of. You know, many times we forget to ask the Lord for help before we go into a difficult situation, don't we? Like Nehemiah, we know a positive outcome is probably not going to happen. That's what we think. They're never going to believe this. They're never going to do that. I don't even know why I'm talking to them. I'm wasting my breath. But God can do all things, can he? He can make possible out of the impossible. And that's what Nehemiah knew. So Nehemiah prayed up. He fasted. Probably gulped. Then entered into the presence of King Artaxerxes. Another part of Nehemiah's job as cupbearer was to always boost the mood of the king. Nehemiah could never have a bad day in front of the king. To make sure he answers the king in the way he needs to, he had to pray going in. But for the first time, Nehemiah was wearing a frown. The king asked him, "Why does your face look so sad when you're not ill?" Has that ever happened to you? You're feeling fine, but you're sad. This can be nothing but sadness of heart. Now let's pause for a moment as Nehemiah turns to the audience and he admits that he's afraid. He's not just a little bit afraid, he's very afraid because he knows he could risk his life by asking the king what he wants to ask him. So in case the king didn't like that sour face, he throws in a little kingly praise before he makes his request. "May the king live forever." Maybe that'll help. Then he tells the majesty what's going on. "Why should my face not look sad when the city where my ancestors are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire?" Off with his head! That's not what happens. Mm-mm. The king did not react with rage. He actually asked Nehemiah what he wants. I love this. Because before Nehemiah responds to make sure he answers the king the way he wants him to answer, he prays silently while they're having a conversation. That's pretty amazing. Have you ever done that? You're having a difficult talk with somebody? I've done that. And I'm praying the whole time I'm talking to them. "Lord, give me the words. I don't know what to say. Give me favor." Whatever it is. I need clarity. Well, that's what Nehemiah was doing. He didn't want to utter a syllable the Lord did not bless. So after praying, he laid it out. Here it goes. "If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my ancestors are buried so that I can rebuild it." Although the word doesn't show it, I've got to believe there was a long pause after that request, don't you think? I'm sure Nehemiah's head was bowed and he was prepared to die. But remember, Nehemiah had a call from God to go back to his homeland. He prayed for favor with the king. He petitioned God while in the middle of a conversation with the king. And we have to remember that when God calls us to a project, no matter what the obstacles are, whether it's a distance issue for putting on a retreat or what Nehemiah had to face, he's going to plow through all the obstacles. When I first thought about attending seminary, the classes I thought started at 4:30 in the afternoon. I got off work at 4:30, so I went to my boss and I asked her, "Do you think I could leave a little early to go and make my seminary classes?" And she said, "You know, I don't think you're going to be able to make up that time if you leave early." So I knew, but I knew that God had called me to seminary. And wouldn't you know it, just a couple of days later, we got this email from Perkins School of Theology saying that they changed the starting time of the class, that instead of 4:30, it was going to now start at 5 o'clock. God plowed through the obstacle because I had a call to attend seminary, just like he plowed through the obstacles for Nehemiah. Meanwhile, back at the palace, the king with the queen sitting stately beside him asked, "Well, how long will your journey take? And when will you get back?" What? The king was letting Nehemiah go. Maybe he should have kissed the king's hand and run out the door after that. But Nehemiah was feeling so good about things. Well, he decided to push for a few more perks. He asked for letters from the governors of the towns surrounding the areas where he'd be traveling through, make sure that he wouldn't have any trouble. Then he pushed the royal privilege a little bit further. He asked for some wood so he could rebuild the gates with the wood that belonged to Persia and to rebuild the walls. And then he also added, "I'd like a little wood to build a house while I'm there, just so I have a place to stay." Anyway, he asked for a lot for his temporary leave in Jerusalem. Why not go for it? And the king agreed. But in reality, it was God who provided for Nehemiah. Many of you know Chris Dunham. He goes to this church. He was an international speaker with Zig Ziglar, traveled all over the world with him. But you may not know that Krish founded a ministry called Mala Ministries in 2008 with his wife Anila. Krish said he moved to the United States in 1986, but he has a heart for the people of his native India. He's a self-proclaimed evangelist to India. He returns there to speak, sometimes preaching messages at 13 to 14 engagements in 8 days. Now, I've had a little taste of that, and we've decided I can't speak every day. I can't even imagine that. However, building a church in India had been on his heart, just as rebuilding the wall was on Nehemiah's heart. And one day, a South Texas rancher handed Krish a check for $15,000 to build a church in India. That's about what it costs to build a church in India. So, according to Krish, the need for a church building in India is seen when there are 250 people gathered on a roof worshiping God. But it's not easy. Krish said the Indian bureaucracy is mind-numbing. There are many hassles and they need a lot of permits. So to eliminate some of the red tape, Krish chose a partner from America who had already built like 16 churches. They were all Assemblies of God churches. And he said the reason why Assemblies of God churches are successful is because the youth like the music and the style of worship that they have. Even with the Assemblies of God connection, there's still a period of preparation before they start this process. Those who build churches first have to fast for 40 days, and they ask God to open the doors that need to be opened to have this church. Christians are by far the minority in India, and there is opposition. But through prayer, through the fasting, they got it done. The church, located at Dumka in the state of Bihar, opened at Easter and was filled to the brim. According to Krish, the church is in the middle of nowhere, plenty of parking, but no cars. I thought that was pretty funny. That's Krish's humor. He says India is the land of his birth. Even with as much privilege as he's had here in the United States, God raised him for India. And this church is an example of how God is working through Krish. Although Nehemiah experienced the privileges of being in a high and lofty position in Persia, he knew that God raised him for Judah, and it was time to go back and help. But when he entered Jerusalem, Nehemiah entered Jerusalem unannounced. He entered Jerusalem unannounced. Just like Krish experienced with India, there was a lot of opposition to this, mainly from a couple of guys named Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite. It's kind of like one of those cartoons where the evil guys come in. Well, these were the evil guys that continued to plague him over and over and over. Sanballat was probably the governor of Samaria. That was the region immediately to the north of Jerusalem. Tobiah was most likely the governor of Ammon. That's the region to the east of Jerusalem, across the Jordan River. It's suspected that they became very rich and powerful, and they did not like it that they were coming back to build the walls back up, because if without walls, the Israelites were vulnerable to them, and they could attack at any time and put that thumb on them to keep them under their thumb. So Nehemiah takes 3 days to get his plan together before he starts rallying the Israelites to do the work. And so this is what, after the 3 days, this is how he addressed the Israelites in Nehemiah 2, 17 through 20. "You see the trouble we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins, and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be in disgrace. I also told them about the gracious hand of God on me and what the king had said to me. And they replied, 'Let's start rebuilding.' So they began this good work. But enter the evil ones." When Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Geshem the Arab heard about it, they mocked and ridiculed us. "What is this you are doing?" they asked. "Are you rebelling against the king?" I answered them by saying, "The God of heaven will give you success. Or give us success. We, his servants, will start rebuilding. But as for you, you have no share in Jerusalem or any claim or historic right to it." There's some flashing lights we have to talk about in this passage. First, in order to motivate the Israelites to do the work, Nehemiah shared his testimony. He talked about how he was convicted to come and help rebuild the walls. He talked about how the king of Persia softened and let him go. And a lot of these people still remember living in Persia, and they knew what it was like to get out of a job like what Nehemiah had. So they were probably very impressed with that. And they knew that he was probably risking his life to leave that job. So that was impressive too. It's like, if he can risk his life, I can build a wall. So he told them his story. And at the end of the passage, when Sanballat and Tobiah challenged the holy rebuilding project, Nehemiah answers, "God will give us success. God will give us success. Doesn't have anything to do with me." Anytime we want to motivate people, we have to show them that we have enthusiasm about the project. We have to tell them our story. We have to tell them how God inspired us. We must believe what we're doing and believe in what we're doing in order for other people to believe in it, to do it. Leadership author and speaker John Maxwell says, "People need to see your conviction." He tells a story about a Scottish philosopher and a religious skeptic, David Hume is his name, really didn't believe in God, but he went to hear evangelist George Whitefield preach. And when this guy asked him, why in the world, you know, this non-believer, why was he going to hear George Whitefield preach? He goes, do you believe in what he's preaching? He goes, absolutely not. But I want to go hear someone who does. George Whitefield believed in what he was saying. To get others to follow us, they have to see your conviction. I personally love to hear about people's close encounters with God. I don't know about you. That's just, whew, gives me chills every time. It strengthens my faith. Nehemiah demonstrated no fear when he didn't back down from Sanballat and Tobiah's threats. He received a calling from God. When you receive a call from God, one that you know, that you know, that you know you've received, do you waffle when you receive resistance? I'm going to tell you, if you don't receive resistance, you've got to question whether it's a call from God. You got to question it. This past week, our Pearls of Promise team went down to San Antonio, as I said. It was an amazing experience, but we had opposition before we left. Lisa Mick had sciatic nerve problems. Karen Hauser, who's not here today, had Hashimoto's disease, and she had a flare-up of that the day before we left. She had to elevate her foot and take some medicine, and I had this horrible back pain in my upper back. I could hardly move one way or the other. And I thought, this is going to be a big event. It's going to be powerful because we are having opposition, all of us. The enemy does not want us to go. So we prayed against it, prayed against the opposition. And wouldn't you know it, the very next day, I'm going, wow, I was trying to make it hurt. I don't feel any back pain. Karen's disease was totally under control. She was fine. And Lisa's sciatic nerve, it started a little bit in the car, but then it went away, didn't it, Lisa? Her sciatic nerve problems went away. There will always be opposition. If your mission is of God, the enemies of God will try to stop you. Nehemiah stayed firm in his calling, so he gave a firm answer to his opposition. Once the threat was deflected, the walls of Jerusalem are now under construction. The walls of Jerusalem are now under construction. Nehemiah's crew began by building the gates. There were 12 entries, representing what? The 12 tribes of Israel. We're not going to go into all the different gates. I know you'll be happy about that. But we're going to talk about one. We're going to talk about the Sheep Gate, because it's a very significant gate. The high priest, Eliashib, and the other priests were in charge of the Sheep Gate. It's interesting that Eliashib's name means God restores. God restores. The Sheep Gate is where the lambs and sheep were brought into the temple when they were offered up as a sacrifice for the people's sins. The Sheep Gate is also a foreshadowing of the perfect sacrifice, the perfect lamb, Jesus Christ. In John 10:7, Jesus refers to himself as the Sheep Gate. Very truly I tell you, I am the gate for the sheep. All who come before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep have not listened to them. I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. There's no need for that kind of sacrifice anymore once Jesus came. He was the perfect sacrifice. And when we enter through Jesus' gate, our lives are restored. So the construction crew, made up of the Israelite people, repaired all the gates and they rebuilt the wall until it was about half the height that it needed to be. But the opposition came again. In Nehemiah 4:7-9, we learn this. But when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, a lot more people now, right? And the people of Ashdod heard that the repairs to Jerusalem's walls had gone ahead and that the gaps were being closed, they were angry. They all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and stir up trouble against it. But we prayed to our God and we posted a guard day and night to meet this threat. By this time, you can imagine, Israelites were tired. They had been working long hours. There was word now that they were surrounded by enemies. What were they going to do? But this is what Nehemiah says to keep the troops' spirits up. Don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome, and fight for your families, your sons, and your daughters, your wives, and your homes. We can listen to that today. God wants us to fight for our daughters, our sons, our homes, our families. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome. He will fight with you and for you. He has the ability to fight your battles. And I wonder what kind of battle you're fighting right now. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome. He can take that on. He can fight the battle for you. As a leader of a project of this magnitude, Nehemiah had to be an encourager. It's human nature for people to want to quit when the going gets tough, isn't it? He had to provide the motivation to persevere. He also had wisdom. He knew because the threat level had risen, the game plan had to change. From that point on, half of the men did the building work, half stood armed, protecting the construction site. And it's very interesting, in Nehemiah 4, Nehemiah said that he nor the men took off their clothes during the entire building project. Okay, ladies, it took about 52 days to build the wall. There were no baths for 52 days. And I thought the smell alone would keep the enemies away. Right? No shower breaks. Nehemiah had to not only deal with national security, he faced domestic unrest as well. Domestic unrest. While building the wall and getting to know the people and their respective body odors, he found out that they had all mortgaged their fields, their vineyards, their homes, just to get grain from some of the more prosperous Jews during the famine that they were also dealing with. They even sold their sons and they sold their daughters to slavery. So Nehemiah, who was now the appointed governor of Judah, called a large meeting to deal with this issue and demanded that all that property be returned back to the people. And those who took it agreed. So got rid of that problem. On top of this, to walk the talk, Nehemiah daily invited 150 people to have dinner with him daily. Can you imagine having 150 people to your house daily to have dinner? Now, it was a common custom for Persian governors, people who were high up in the Persian government, to do this and to invite people over for dinner. And in Nehemiah 5:19, he asked God to remember him with favor for all that he'd done for the people. I think by that statement, we can assume that Nehemiah was doing this because he thought it was the right thing to do, not necessarily because he wanted to do it. He was being obedient. Obedience is not always what we drift towards, is it? If it were, it'd be a different name besides obedience. I looked up the Greek word for obedience. It's hypakoi. It means to listen to or to hearken to. God calls us all to listen to him and act on his promptings. In 1 Peter 1:14 through 15, the word speaks to this. As obedient children, children who listen and hearken, do not conform to the evil desires you had when you lived in ignorance, but just as he who called you is holy, so be holy in all you do, for it is written, be holy because I am holy. Nehemiah probably paid for that food for 150 people out of his own pocket. He might have wanted to save the money, but he was being obedient, hypakou, and holy as God is holy. It was the godly thing to do. Unfinished work requires total focus. Now we come to my favorite passage in all of Nehemiah because I think it sums up this entire story. It's a phrase we should all remember and use in our own lives when distractions try to pull us away from God's work for us. Nehemiah's opposition had no luck stopping the building project. They could not attack the Jews because, remember, they had the perimeter covered. No baths because they were covering the perimeter 24 hours a day. So Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem the Arab figure, if they can get Nehemiah to leave the construction project, then they can kill him. And there'll be no leader. So they ask him to drop his hammer and come to lunch. And Nehemiah, did they think he was an idiot? Nehemiah didn't fall for that. And he decided to send them a message. And this is the message he sent them. Tell them, I am doing a great work so that I cannot come down. I am doing a great work so that I cannot come down. I want to pull up to this passage and I want to set a spell. Because the entire book of Nehemiah, as I said, can be summarized in those words. I am doing a great work so that I cannot come down. Nehemiah risked his life to carry on this project. He left a secure job as a cupbearer, had it all, to take a job out of town full of trials and danger. He and scores of workers spent 52 nights without a bath. That's enough to stop me from doing it. Building walls and fighting off the enemies. Wearisome, physical labor, but they were carrying on a great work, the work of God, and they could not come down. When you are working on an important project for God, do you eliminate the distractions? If it's something in the area of ministry, does it take forever to complete because of different things that pull at you? Maybe you're like me, you get a lunch invitation from somebody, and you might be working on something, and the minute you get that lunch invitation, you drop everything and you go. I like lunch. I have a lunch ministry, as my husband calls it. A lot of times that email will come in, I'm writing, and I immediately click off of what I'm writing to see who's emailing me, and it's usually disappointing. It's usually my friend Ann Taylor or that fruity gal, Banana Republic. I'm like, why did I click off? Why did I do that? Are you like me doing housework? You start something, like you start one project, the dishes maybe. I know I'm famous for starting to load the dishwasher and leave the dishwasher and then think, oh, I've got to put that load of laundry in the laundry, and I start doing that, and then I forget to start it, and then I go back to something else. Beth Moore talks about this. She says she does that, and she just has to yell at herself, finish it! Just finish it! That's what I tell myself too. Finish it, just finish it. And that's what Nehemiah was telling these men. Finish it. We have to finish it. We're doing a good work. He earlier asked God to remember those people that he provided dinner for, and remember me for what I was doing. But he also asked God to remember in a different way Sanballat and Tobiah. You know, remember what they're doing to me, Lord, and you just take care of them. And I don't think it was pretty what he was hoping for. And when word got back to Nehemiah's enemies that the wall had been completed, all the huffing and puffing, all the threats, everything had stopped. Because once that wall was up, they knew they had no power over the Israelites. Now the walls are restored, the Israelites desire to undo the past. Now that the walls are restored, the Israelites desire to undo the past. So God begins the process of restoration with the people of Judah. The walls are restored, now it's time for the people's hearts. And his people do start out with the right attitude. They understand why they were allowed to be carried off into exile. Remember the whole thing that we talked about in Jeremiah where they were carried off. And they didn't understand. Jeremiah had been warning them and warning them this is going to happen. Unless you repent, the Babylonians are going to come in. They're going to take you away in shackles. You've got to repent. And they never listened. But now they get it. So to start off with fully knowledgeable about the do's and don'ts in God's world, Ezra the scribe stands on a lofty wooden platform and begins to praise God before reading the words of the law. And the people praise God along with him, bowing down and worshiping the Lord with their faces to the ground. Were these really the people that worshiped thousands of gods, bowing down now to the one true God? And as the law of the Lord was read, they wept. Conviction pelted them like a heavy rainfall, and they were drenched in their tears. But I love this. When Nehemiah witnessed their remorse, he said, "Do not grieve, for the joy of the Lord is your strength." Have you ever had somebody apologize to you for something, and they get all upset? And it was enough. It's just enough. Okay. Don't grieve. Let's have joy now, because you feel the remorse, and that's all you needed. The joy of the Lord is your strength. So the Jews dried their tears for now and celebrated the completion of the wall for 7 days, and that festival is called the Festival of the Booths. You may have heard of that. And when the party was over after 7 days, that's some party, I'll say, 7 straight days, it was now time for the mourning. The Israelites gathered together, they fasted, they wore sackcloth, and they had dust on their heads, and they prayed before the Lord their God, confessing their sins and the sins of their fathers. Did you get that? They confessed their sins and the sins of their fathers. Now that was new for me. Don't you love it when the Word gives you something new? There's always something there. They confessed the sins of their fathers, and I thought, I'd never done that. I don't know about you. You may have a perfect family, but there's a lot of generational sin in my family. So there are a lot of sins to confess from my family. So I began to pray and confess the sins of my mother, my father, my grandmother, my grandfather, and all the rest of my family members. It was healing for me. And when we do that, we can overcome all those strongholds, those generational curses that have been passed down to us. We can break the cycle when we do that, and we can claim victory. And it's right there in the Ten Commandments when God commands that we don't have any idols before Him. Listen to this closely. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. And that sounds tough, doesn't it? But here's the mercy. But showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. Obedient. When we're obedient, we can break that cycle. Hapakawi. Listening to God and acting on His words. We are always affected by our family's sin, but we have the power to overcome that generational baggage and not only experience God's love in our lives, but also we open the door for God's love to flow through our lives to our children, on to our grandchildren, and to 1,000 generations. And why do I believe that? Because God said it. God said it, and He promised it for us. Thanks to Nehemiah's leadership, Jerusalem was on its way to being restored. When they dedicated the new wall of Jerusalem, it was a celebration like none other. There were songs of thanksgiving, there was music from cymbal, there were harps, there were lyres, and singers were brought together from all around. And you choir people will love this. There was a choir on one wall, and there was a choir on the other wall singing. There were financial offerings to pay for those who served. According to the Quest Study Bible, when we work with God on any great endeavor, we're not done until we celebrate and dedicate the work. I love a party, so I can go with that. Celebration involves the entire congregation and takes full advantage of music and ceremony to heighten the sense of joy and worship. Here's the important thing. Dedication reminds us of our dependence on God and invites Him to guard the work accomplished by His help. That's why the church here made such a big deal when we dedicated the Family Life Center right over here. We were dedicating the work to God, and there's a lot of ministry that goes on in that building now, isn't there, ladies? A lot of ministry, and it cannot be accomplished without His help. Nehemiah didn't hang around forever in Jerusalem. He had a promise. He told King Artaxerxes that he would go back and resume his job as cupbearer. But years later, he did come back to see how things were going. And unfortunately, he found out that the people were being unfaithful to God again. How could that be? They were unfaithful again. They had defiled the temple by letting someone set up a residence there. They weren't honoring the Sabbath, and they were marrying people outside their faith. I had a humorous thought about that. I picture Nehemiah walking into the temple, seeing somebody brushing his teeth or something, you know, in the temple. You know, there's somebody living there. But it's human nature to backslide, isn't it? Into sinful behavior. So Nehemiah, what did he do? He kicked the freeloader out of the temple and strongly encouraged the people to get back to what they promised they would do. And for the most part, they did. Nehemiah is a member of the uncrowd because on paper, he was not the man for the job. He was out of town. He had a prestigious job, the king's cupbearer, and he didn't have any lengthy vacation to leave. He was out of his skill set. He'd never built a wall or been a construction foreman before. But he felt the call of God on his life. And he knew that he was the one God had appointed to rebuild the wall of Jerusalem. Nehemiah moved forward, even though the odds were against him, praying every step of the way. Maybe it's not a construction project, but God is calling you to serve him in some way, and you keep fighting him because you've never done it before. And it's really out of your comfort zone. How many times has that happened to me? I know. I'm the poster child for that. But we can learn from Nehemiah's story. If you can't shake a vision, pray that God will open the doors so that you can proceed, and you will know in your heart that you are doing a good work and you cannot come down until it's finished. To God be the glory.